This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on June 30th, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, June 30th will come to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to the building this morning. Just so you know, we do have open meetings regularly, and you're all welcome back for any of those. I assure you, we have very interesting topics all the time here at the Federal Election Commission. The first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of minutes. Commissioner Weintraub, do you have a motion, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And we do have a correction today. I move to approve the minutes of June 15th, 2011, as set forth in Agenda Document 11-39, with the correction of the spelling of Mr. Kovas's name on page 8.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries 6-0. The next matter on today's agenda is an advisory opinion request submitted on behalf of Stephen Colbert, filed by Mr. Potter, Mr. Birkenstock, and Mr. Sanderson. The FEC responds to requests for advisory opinions when filed by requesters. They present a particular proposal for a course of action, and if the Commission approves the request, they provide the protection for that course of action to the requester. The agency adopted a new procedure in 2009 to allow requesters to appear before the Commission when it considers the request to answer any questions that the commissioners may have. Unlike a court or a congressional hearing, we do not have a procedure to allow for testimony from requesters. I understand that at least one of my colleagues has questions for the requester, so I'd ask Mr. Potter, Mr. Sanderson, and Mr. Colbert to please take a seat at the table. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
We have David Adkins, Peter Reynolds, and Amy Rothstein from the Office of General Counsel with us. Mr. Adkins, please proceed when you're ready.
Before we get started, I think we have some late submitted documents.
We do. Thank you, counsel.
Pleasure.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-38A and 11-38B.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries 6-0.
Thank you and good morning, commissioners. You have for your consideration three draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted by Mr. Stephen Colbert. The request presents questions regarding Mr. Colbert's plans to establish and operate a political committee, the Colbert Super PAC, and whether that PAC would be in receipt of reportable in-kind contributions from Viacom if Viacom's show, The Colbert Report, covers and provides to the PAC advertisements and administrative support. All three drafts, drafts A, B, and C, reach the same conclusions on the following issues. The PAC may solicit and accept contributions in unlimited amounts for the purpose of making independent expenditures. The PAC may solicit and accept these contributions even if the PAC also receives in-kind contributions from Viacom. And the Colbert Report's coverage of the PAC is protected by the press exemption and would not result in an in-kind contribution from Viacom. The drafts reach different conclusions, however, with respect to the Colbert Report's support of the PAC. Specifically, Draft A concludes that if the show provides independent expenditure advertisements to the PAC or assists in the administration of the PAC, costs associated with those activities would be reportable in-kind contributions from Viacom to the PAC. By contrast, Draft B and C conclude that costs associated with those activities are protected by the press exemption and thus would not constitute reportable in-kind contributions from Viacom to the PAC. The Commission received 4 comments on the request, 5 comments on the draft, and as always, we'd be happy to address any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adkins. Today's request presents the relatively novel issue of how the press exemption applies to coverage of a political committee that will provide an on-air premise for discussing campaign finance rules and other aspects of American politics. And while Mr. Colbert's show may bring some levity to the topic of campaign finance issues, the questions and the request before us today deserve serious consideration. The draft opinions differ, as Mr. Adkins point out, as to whether Viacom's costs of producing independent expenditure advertisements provided to the committees to distribute outside of the show or the costs of administration qualify for the press exemption. There is a proposed consensus amendment set out in agenda document 1128B, that, 1138B, to make some minor revisions to the proposed draft. These edits are not intended to be substantive changes, but rather to clarify the scope of the opinion and to emphasize some of the particular facts of this request. I will be supporting revised draft A with the amendment. I think this draft most appropriately applies the Reader's Digest test with respect to the question of whether Viacom will be engaging in press functions when conducting these particular activities at issue. And it seems clear to me that coverage of the committee on the show, including production of advertisements for the committee, will be comparative in form to segments previously aired on the show and thus would be covered by the press exemption. But it also seems clear that it is not part of Viacom's legitimate press function to provide independent expenditure advertisements to a political committee, including the committee as part of the request here. Similarly, it's not part of Viacom's legitimate press function to pay for the committee's administration costs. This conclusion is consistent with past commission decisions and court precedent. I will open it up to other commissioners for any discussion or questions. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I'm going to have a few questions in a minute, but I'd like to state where I am. I agree with most of what the chair said. I think that the talking about the PAC on the show is protected speech and is exempted from the act. Whether one views it as press or commentary or whatnot, it's fine. I'm more interested in the question about advertising, perhaps on other shows, and the administration of the PAC. And the question, as I see it, is where does commentary end and where does normal campaign finance law begin? My sense and the way I read the request is that the administration of the PAC is part of the commentary in and of itself, because if you can't pay for the administration of the PAC, you can't have the PAC. And if you're going to do other advertising, to me, that's also part of commentary. So the draft C is the draft I support, and I think I may be the only one on that, but I have a few questions for Mr. Potter, and just as a preface, Mr. Colbert, you're represented by counsel, so I'm going to address questions to counsel, and if your counsel feels you have information that would assist the commission, he can turn to you, but my habit is to ask counsel the question and then leave it to him to decide who answers, if so that we understand ourselves. Chairman Potter, right? As I understand it, Comedy Central is owned by another company, which is owned by another company. And to me, it doesn't really matter who owns who, but you have MTV in there, you have Viacom in there, and they are, in my mind, one large entity that produce TV and entertainment shows and whatnot. These other ads, and it's tough to say what they'll be because we haven't said yes to the PAC yet. So without saying yes, you probably don't know what the ads are going to say. But I could envision ads consistent with other ads I've seen on the show. Do you envision placing these on stations other than those owned by Viacom? And the reason why I ask is I'm not sure that other stations would accept essentially advertising for competitor shows, right? Or do you see it on other Viacom-owned shows?
Thank you, Commissioner McGann. As a lawyer, I appreciate your rules of the road. As a lawyer, my rule is always to defer to my client. I will answer the question and then see if he wants to add anything, if I may. I think the answer is that the PAC, in the advisory opinion, specifically envisioned taking out advertising as a PAC in various states that have primaries or other political activity going on, and doing so on networks other than Viacom. That the PAC itself would be the entity that would be purchasing the advertising, and it would envision doing so on non-Viacom shows. You're right that a show could decline to show PAC advertising, but we haven't crossed that bridge. Is there anything you want to add, Mr. Colbert?
Yes, other than we don't know what we're going to do with the ads, where we would place them, because we don't have the pack yet. You're right in surmising that. That's why I hope to get the pack so we can find out.
Thank you. If you place ads, though, on Viacom-owned stations, so the pack would still pay, because what I'm hung up on is the TV time, my understanding, and I'm not necessarily knowledgeable on the inner workings of how Viacom works, but sometimes they have cross-promotional budgets and whatnot, so there's not actually money changing hands when there's an ad on MTV for a show that's on another Viacom-owned show. And I was thinking about this, and I thought, gee, you know, when you watch your local TV shows, around 4 o'clock on come the ads for the local news that night that says, tonight, tune in and see breaking news about cat stuck in tree, and maybe tonight we're going to endorse so-and-so for Congress. That ad wouldn't trigger a separate IE report, in my view. I think that's the news advertising the news, even though that's an ad, and I don't think stations pay for that. I think that's part of their promotional budget, but I think some may. And I'm approaching this from that point of view, and that's why I see these ads as part of the commentary and perhaps part of media editorial and commentary and not something that would require a report, because otherwise I feel like I'm in a position to decide what's part of the Colbert Report and what's not for purposes of FEC disclosure. And I'm looking maybe for some help on factually the difference, because I come at this as someone who's represented media buyers before I got here and that kind of thing. I want to make sure I'm not operating on any sort of erroneous premises before I vote.
I think for purposes of the advisory opinion request, we were envisioning that the PAC would actually purchase airtime, whether from stations around the country that are not controlled or owned by Viacom or from Viacom. We have not crossed the bridge that you are addressing, which would be the possibility of Viacom doing something that would promote the PAC. We were looking at it solely from the aspect of actually purchasing time.
Because I'd hate to have it, you come back or you hesitate to do something because you're afraid or Viacom's afraid or nervous that it may cause some FEC problems. I mean, to me, at least for me, all this is commentary, and it's part of a long tradition of and a necessary part of our political process. Any idea what the ads on other stations may say? I mean, I assume they would reference a candidate or expressly advocate election or defeat. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having a discussion about reporting them. So would the ads be a form of commentary? I was going to wait for you to have your chat, finish my question. So my guess is the ads could be seen as another form of commentary, and that's why I'm leaning towards draft C, which gives you essentially a lot more freedom to not worry about reporting things and whatnot. But if it's not commentary, then I'm in a little bit of a tougher spot.
When we faced the question of whether we needed an advisory opinion request, we, in talking with Mr. Colbert, ascertained that he did intend some of the advertising to include express advocacy, mention candidates, and be a standard support or oppose type of ad, thus the advisory opinion request. I think we really don't know whether there would be other ads in this format of paid advertising time in an advertising slot that did not reach that level of advocacy. That's just something we haven't addressed.
And that's why I have trouble today voting for the AO that says there's a reporting obligation on that, because I'm not sure that I'm comfortable tying up the answer to that in what's essentially a hypothetical. I mean, I could imagine I remember a situation years ago where a member of Congress switched parties, and the party which he left sent a mail piece to the new party's list and it was a Republican becoming a Democrat, and the Republican Party sent mail in the Democratic primary saying, if you support, if you value your gun rights, this is your candidate. If you value life, this is your candidate. They sent it to the pro-choice list, right? And if you looked at the piece of mail, it seemed like a positive, you know, serious piece of advocacy, but the target audience took it, I guess, the right way, and, well, that person lost his primary to an elderly woman who raised maybe $100 because this mail got everyone ginned up. So commentary, to me, is a slippery concept, and I'm having trouble being the one who decides what is commentary and what is not commentary, and that was really the point of my question. Because we're in an interesting era now, post-Citizens United, and many say, well, this is, you know, the Supreme Court's given speech rights to corporations, but that's not really what happened. Many corporations had speech rights before Citizens United. Supreme Court, even in Austin, said corporations did have speech rights. It's just, did the government have a compelling interest to silence certain corporations? And the corporations who had speech rights were the media and people who maybe were like the media. And now you don't necessarily have to be funny to speak. And fortunately, we don't have to decide who gets to speak and who doesn't speak. So that's really, to me, much more the holding of Citizens United, not that all of a sudden new people can speak. It's that it's more of a of removing shackles of certain kinds of folk, and I don't want to continue to go down the old road. I mean, you remember the Reader's Digest case, which the media exemption, the way the FEC does it, is comes from an old case where the FEC sued Reader's or investigated Reader's Digest for a story they were running on Ted Kennedy back in the 1980 election, and district court said, hold on a minute, FEC, you need to think this through. This looks like the media, and articulated a two-part test. And I'm not sure that test fits because it talks about the traditional media and legitimate media function. And nowadays, that really seems to be blurring. I think your client's show is much more consistent with a much longer tradition. But with Internet bloggers and the like, the difference between the media and everyone else is becoming much more difficult. And I hate to vote for something today that may cause problems later for either your client or similarly situated clients. So I can't support the draft. I think everyone else is supporting for those reasons. I want to articulate that. I appreciate you answering the questions. And I don't have any further questions. Do you have anything else you'd like to add in response to anything I've said?
You're kind. I think the only response I'd make is to say that obviously my client here is Mr. Colbert and the proposed Colbert Super PAC, and thus not the Viacom, the owner of the media entity. And there are questions I think you're raising that may be questions for Viacom internally or at some future point, but that affect their speech. What we were looking at, and thus the advisory opinion request, was the more basic issue of if you're going to have a PAC, what does it have to report? So we're looking at it from the PAC perspective. In that regard, one thing I wanted to note, which I think is on the public record, but I wanted to be clear on it, is that the drafts, all of them, refer sort of in a mandatory way in draft A to Viacom making an in-kind contribution to the PAC if the PAC uses Viacom film footage. And I wanted to note that, as we did in the letter of June 13th, responding to questions from the General Counsel's office, that Viacom already has in place in the marketplace a licensing program where it makes available to other entities Viacom footage at standard marketplace rates. And therefore, it is possible, certainly, that the PAC could pay for footage rather than having Viacom make an in-kind contribution.
That would be an in-kind. And I'm not sure. Does the draft, in your view, cause a problem if you do a license, or is it only a draft, or is it just not quite as clear as it could be?
Well, my sense is it does not cause a problem because it presumes it will be in-kind, but there's nothing in the draft that indicates you couldn't avail yourself of the standard FEC regulations for marketplace
and
exchange
for footage,
and purchase.
Essentially, right? Yeah. Or licensing it, or however you want to do it as a business matter. Mm-hmm. All I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion or questions for requester? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Colbert, not only for coming in today and presenting us with this interesting question, but for raising the profile on the important issues that we deal with every day.
You're welcome.
We don't usually, as the chair indicated, get this many people who show up, and certainly we don't get the camera crews. If we had been hiding under a rock somewhere and were not aware before you walked in the door that you are a member of the media, I think the presence of all the cameras might have tipped us off. So that part of the question was actually quite easy. And, of course, we've already answered the question in previous AO about whether Viacom is a member of the media. And it is. In some ways, had you presented your question a little bit differently, it would have been an easier question. Some of the comments that we received from the public indicated that they view what you do as parody. And had we viewed this as a request about parody, which was not the way you presented it to us, we could have viewed it in the long tradition of political humor. Saturday Night Live, Laugh-In, Will Rogers. I'm sure there was somebody standing on a soapbox back in revolutionary days making fun of Tom Jefferson and John Adams. And I don't know that anybody has ever suggested that Saturday Night Live or NBC needs to file an independent expenditure report every time they do have one of their comedians stand up and do an impression of a candidate asking for votes. So if we viewed this as just a funny request, then that actually would have been a lot easier. And it would have been easier also to give a more open-ended, sure, do whatever you want, have fun, and we'll all have fun watching kind of answer. But you've posed a serious request, and you say you actually want to set up a PAC and raise and spend money and put independent expenditures on air them in other places. And of course, what we tell you will apply to other folks as well. Now, whether there is anybody who is quite similarly situated to you, Mr. Colbert, I'm not sure. You may just be unique. But there certainly will be other commentators on other shows who will feel that the advice we give to you also applies to them. So we have to be careful that the advice that we give to you will also be appropriate when the commentators on Fox and MSNBC and all the other networks decide that it's not just advice for Comedy Central. It's advice for all of them as well. And that's why I'm going to be supporting Draft A. I thought Draft A was fine the way it was. There was some discussion as to whether some clarification needed to be made, and so I'm happy to support the amendments that were crafted yesterday and released, with our apologies, very late, to get consensus on that document. But I do think that it strikes the right balance between protecting your right to be on TV and make whatever commentary you want to make in whatever form you want to make it, and be as entertaining as you can be, and you are. But at the same time, making sure that we're not providing advice that is going to be used by other folks in a way that might not be so funny. And that's no questions, just an explanation for where I'm voting.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd first like to just ask a brief question of Mr. Potter. We circulated this document that contains the amendments to proposed draft A rather late. Didn't give you a lot of time to respond. Just wanted to first of all ask whether or not you had any questions or concerns related to those proposed amendments that you'd like to set forth.
You're kind again. No, I don't think so. I think we understand the guidance in what would be the revised draft A.
Okay. I too am going to be supporting draft A with the amendments that are set forth in agenda document 11-38-B. For me, the initial answers to the questions posed by Mr. Colbert were relatively straightforward and relatively easy to arrive at, and that is, yes, Mr. Colbert may establish a super PAC, and yes, any costs incurred by Viacom that relate to the show's coverage of the super PAC fully qualify for the press exemption, and thus these costs would not need to be reported. The trickier questions related to the costs associated with producing the independent expenditure ads that would be aired on other shows and networks, as well as the costs associated with the PAC. I think it's worth reemphasizing what others have said, is that as an initial matter, nothing under the Federal Election Campaign Act prohibits Viacom from picking up the costs for those independent expenditure ads or for administering the PAC. under the Constitution, Viacom is entitled to pick up those costs. The only question is whether or not those costs would have to be reported to the commission. As the chair pointed out, we do have a long line of matters and cases where we've analyzed the press exemption. This one certainly is a more unusual one than most. I'm not breaking any news when I say that, but the most important question is analyzing whether the entity at issue is acting within the legitimate press function. And to in order to qualify for the legitimate press function, it doesn't mean that you have to be perfectly objective, nonpartisan, unfunny. There are none of those factors need to be in place to be able to deliver commentary or deliver editorials that are fully protected by the press exemption. But when an entity begins engaging in electioneering and campaigning actively and using means that are outside the normal form and that they normally deliver their message, then it cannot necessarily be said that they're acting within the legitimate press function. So I am prepared to support draft A, and it's probably worth just briefly describing what that is, just to add a couple of things to what Mr. Adkins described earlier. And that's, you know, if we look at the costs that are related to the show's coverage of the Super PAC, including any costs associated with producing independent expenditure ads that are shown only on the show, those are fully covered by the press exemption, and those do not need to be reported. So anything related to Mr. Colbert or others on the show discussing the PAC's activities or operations, referring to its website, talking about audience participation activities, all of that falls within the press exemption. None of the costs that are related to those activities have to be reported. Costs related to independent expenditure ads that are produced by Viacom that are both featured on the show and then also used by the PAC as paid advertising on other shows, those costs, if the production and distribution costs related to distributing those ads outside the show, those would have to be considered in-kind contributions unless, as Mr. Potter pointed out, there was a licensing agreement where a fair market exchange was made. But otherwise, the costs related to featuring those ads on the show are fully covered by the press exemption as well. And then under draft A, costs related to administering the PAC would have to be considered in-kind contributions if those weren't reimbursed by the PAC. So at the appropriate time, I'm also prepared to support draft A. And I just want to say that I think my colleague, Commissioner McGann, raises a lot of very interesting points about the press exemption and what is the press, especially post-Citizens United, especially as technological developments have made the lines that distinguish between what is the press and what is not the press much more blurry than they were before. But I believe that that draft A is consistent with our past advisory opinions. I think they're consistent with the court decisions that have dealt with the press exemption. And so at the appropriate time, I'll be happy to support draft A as amended by the memo that was circulated last night.
Is there any further discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also will support draft A, and I'm glad to see us approaching this question with such unanimity, because as you may know, we're not always quite this way. But in this particular case, I'm glad to see us be able to give guidance that you can walk out the door with some confidence that it will apply at least as to us, and not just based upon the composition at a particular given time. I did want to say that I think all of us are reconsidering what to do in the aftermath of Citizens United. And the press exemption is no exception to that either, because the press exemption, to a large degree, had its underpinnings based upon when a corporation could engage in express advocacy and certain kinds of political speech. And now in the aftermath of Citizens United, that underpinning is now no longer there. And so the question now becomes, if you apply the press exemption, there are certain expenditures or receipts do not have to be reported, but if you do, then but if you apply the press exemption, they do not have to be reported, and if you don't, then the normal reporting would take place. So I think we need to consider that, because for me, what we really have left here is disclosure, and I think the public, and I certainly am one of those, think that disclosure of political speech is very important, and even the Supreme Court was able to say that with some strength in the Citizens United case. So in the future, I'm not sure whether to what degree we should reconsider when we apply it, in our view, but at least in this case, of course, with Viacom, it's been before us twice before, and there's really no question in my mind that your show fits within, you know, what we've done before and probably in the future. So I'm pleased to support draft A.
Any further comments? Are we ready for a motion? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to make a motion that we approve with respect to draft A as set forth in Agenda Document 11-38, Question 1, the response to Question 1 is set forth on pages 6 and 7, and Question 3 as set forth on page 15. I'm admitting the answer to Question 2 from my motion for the reasons I stated previously. Although I agree with part of the answer that's given in draft A to Question 2, specifically the part that airtime and related costs incurred by Viacom will be exempt from reporting requirements under the press exemption, I just can't get there today with the remainder of the answer because I remain skeptical that we can at this time really say that other advertising and other activity by Viacom is definitely something that needs to be reported, because I can envision things that would be commentary. And I hope we keep an open mind to that in the event that does become the case, that we'd be willing to take a second look. And I think this is consistent with Commissioner Walter just said about post-CU, who's the media and who's not the media. We're all reflecting on that. My view is that how the commission's done it before CU is in large part been superseded by Citizens United, and I really do think we have to take a look at it, because if we don't, we're going to be in a situation where we are going to unintentionally cross the line and probably end up with another Citizens United type decision down the road. So I think we do have to exercise some caution, and I think we're doing that. And I'm glad, and I echo Commissioner Walter's comments about it. This is basically unanimous, other than my one little problem with an issue that, in my view, isn't quite ripe necessarily. So I can't support A in full, but I made my motion on the parts I can, and hope others can at least support me in part, and then vote on the rest without me, and then we move on. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner McGann. Yes, we will have a second vote after this motion. So all those in favor of Commissioner McGann's motion, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Is there another motion? Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve Agenda Document 11-38, which is Draft A, as amended by 11-38B, with technical and conforming changes.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries 5-1. So although we have just taken two separate votes, there will be one advisory opinion. Mr. Colbert, you may form your PAC and proceed as the commission has advised in this opinion. With that concludes this discussion of this advisory opinion. The commission will take a 15-minute recess and convene at 10 minutes until 11. Thank you.
You have your pack.
The open meeting of June 30th will reconvene. Thank you for staying to watch the rest of our very interesting agenda. The next advisory opinion on our agenda is 2011-12 by Majority PAC and House Majority PAC by Mark Elias, Ezra Reese, and Jonathan Burkon. We have late submitted documents in this advisory opinion. Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-37A and 11-37B.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries 6-0. Mr. Lutz, please proceed when ready.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly, and good morning, Commissioners.
Agenda documents 11-37, 37-A, and 37-B respond to an advisory opinion request filed by Majority PAC and House Majority PAC. The committees are non-connected independent expenditure-only committees. They ask whether federal candidates and office holders and officers of national party committees may solicit unlimited funds from individuals, corporations, and labor organizations on behalf of the committees, and if not, whether the covered individuals may participate in fundraisers for such funds. Agenda document 37 concludes that covered individuals may not solicit such funds, but that the covered individuals may attend, speak at, or be featured guests at fundraisers for the committees at which unlimited individual, corporate, and labor organizations are solicited, so long as the covered individuals do not solicit such contributions themselves. Agenda document 37A concludes that the covered individuals may solicit unlimited contributions from individuals, corporations, and labor organizations on behalf of the committees. And finally, Agenda Document 37-B concludes that while covered individuals may not solicit unlimited contributions from individuals, corporations, or labor organizations, covered individuals may solicit up to $5,000 from individuals and any other source not prohibited by the Act from making a contribution to political committees. This draft also concludes that the covered individuals may attend, speak at, or be featured guests at fundraisers for the committees, so long as the covered individuals restrict their solicitations to funds subject to the limitations, prohibitions, and reporting requirements of the Act. We received 5 comments on the request and 3 comments on the draft, as well as some ex parte communications. Thank you, and I will address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Council. Any discussion by commissioners or questions for Council? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment on the revised draft A, which I will be supporting. In some ways, we are giving the requester more than he asked for, because I don't think he asked one of the questions that we're answering in here, but since it seems to have caused some confusion, the issue of whether office holders could solicit up to the federally permissible amounts, $5,000 for a PAC. That wasn't part of the original request, and I tend to think that requesters get to choose what questions they want to ask and what questions they want to leave unasked, but I gather from the comment that we received on the revision that you're happy to have the answer to that question, particularly the way revised draft A answers it. I don't think it was a very controversial answer, and I'm happy to provide it and to support revised draft A.
Any further comments? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I'm also in support of revised draft A. The question presented is if you have a PAC, and I guess we call them super PACs, or people call them super PACs, meaning a political committee that is only going to do independent expenditures, and therefore there's no contribution limits per the Speech Now decision and some other cases, I suppose. What if a member of Congress or a candidate wishes to solicit money? Can they do it? And if so, well, how much? You didn't really ask the if so, but it seems to be a it seems to flow from the request. It's not an easy question, because on the one hand you have a PAC that can accept unlimited money, but yet it files with the FEC, so it is subject to the reporting obligations of the Act, and another statute that says members of Congress and candidates can solicit money subject to the limits, prohibitions, and reporting requirements of the Act. But now this committee doesn't have source prohibitions, but a lot of the traditional ones are not there, and the limits are no longer there. So what does that mean? And the original draft A, I thought, sort of reached the right result, but the rationale I thought was okay, but it wasn't quite as crisp as I thought, because I thought the statute is something that needed a little more discussion. So I think we worked on revised draft A, and we ended up with something I think is a little bit more of a mechanical application of the statute, because the statute itself governs the solicitation by the office holder or candidate, and I see that as a contribution limit. The reason why Speech Now works is to put a contribution limit on an independent spending group. It's essentially a backdoor spending limit, so it's not really a contribution limit because, well, there's no corruption or appearance thereof. Here, however, you have an office holder soliciting money, and that's a little bit different. So I think that the limit does apply. By analogy, I thought of maybe a state legislative race in Virginia has no limits, but yet a member of Congress can't raise anything goes. It has to be subject to the other limit, the candidate limit, and you ask, well, why? Well, because of the statute. Now, there are other arguments to this, and I'm not entirely sure that I'm absolutely correct here. The statute, it's cross-referenced, okay, so that maybe that means something, maybe it doesn't. It's in a little bit different section. I mean, there's different subparts of the statute. But at the end of the day, Citizens United, Emily's List, Speech Now, whatever case you want to pick that says you can give to a PAC without limits, does not address the ability of federal office holders and candidates to raise money for the PAC. And in fact, that issue was raised in some form in McConnell. McConnell upheld it at least on its face. I'm sure somewhere at some time someone will have an as-applied challenge that presents a factual situation that shows maybe it goes too far. Maybe a member of Congress who's going to retire and is not up for re-election and the Congress hasn't adjourned sine die, but there's one vote left, wants to raise money for this PAC, so where's the corruption because, well, there's no votes left. I could see potential as applied, but that's not what we're doing here today. That seems something that would end up in court. Requester's not asking that. He's asking the much simpler question. And on the law as it appears on the books, the way I read it, the statute that regulates the ability of congressmen and candidates from raising money hasn't been touched directly by these court cases. There's probably other cases that one could argue have indirectly touched. You may have an associational case. You may have an equal protection case. That's not before us today. That's for another day, and probably not a day that we're going to be a part of. It's probably going to be, someone's in a court challenge or something. But for now, I think it makes sense to, even though it's not specifically addressed, say they can at least raise up to five. Then they're clear, and then the PAC has a piece of paper that they can hand to potential solicitors to say, look, you're covered. The FEC has said this. And I think it reaches the right result. We've already done a rulemaking on and simplified the rules on federal office holder participation in events. It was confusing before. Parties had one rule. Others had another rule. It's been simplified about how you show up, what you can and can't do. I think the draft, revised A, ties it to the reg, so then you have that to go on. And I'm glad to see that we were able to come up with a draft that I think is the result that, well, the statute says should be the result. Logically, it's the result. And you know, if somebody comes in with a different request with some other fact pattern and says, look, it goes too far in this case, I'm all ears, but that's not what we're here to do. That's not what we're here to do today. I intend on supporting revised draft A. Thank you.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, am planning to support revised draft A and for the reasons that have been articulated by others thus far. The question that was presented to us it certainly is an interesting one. And in recent years, we frequently talk about how much the campaign finance legal landscape has been dramatically altered as a result of a number of prominent court cases, most notably Citizens United. And the question here was whether or not those alterations were sufficiently seismic to allow federal office holders and candidates and party officers to basically make unlimited, to make solicitations of in unlimited amounts from individuals, corporations, labor unions. And as my colleague Commissioner McGann just pointed out, there really are two statutory provisions that we have to consider. There are the limits on what an entity may receive, which are set forth in 441A, subsection A, and then there are the limits on what a member or a candidate can solicit, and those are set forth in section 441I, subsection E. And most of the times, those limits will coincide. But as Commissioner McGann pointed out, not always. And he gave the example of the state legislative race in the state of Virginia. And this is also another case where I think that those limits diverge. Because while it is true that what we now call as super PACs have no limits on what they can receive, the provision which put limits on what an office holder or a candidate may solicit hasn't been touched. It wasn't brought up in Citizens United. It wasn't brought up in Speech Now. And this provision was upheld against a facial challenge in McConnell. So until there are further developments in the courts or unless Congress wanted to change that, there's not a lot we can do to change that. We really have no choice but to otherwise conclude that the limits that are set forth, and in this case a $5,000 limit, that governs. And so that's where I think, again, a lot has changed, but not everything has changed. And I think at this point, unless and until there are further developments either in Congress or in the courts, I think that this is the correct conclusion. And so at the appropriate time, I plan on supporting revised draft A.
Thank you. Any further comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support draft A also. And even though it doesn't touch exactly, it goes a little beyond what the request is, I think it's only natural that we answer the questions.
Anything further? Vice Chair Hunter, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve Agenda Document 11-37B, which is revised Draft A.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0.
Congratulations,
moment
Mr. Elias. That doesn't happen too often.
In the room. We have just a couple of quick matters that I'd like to take a moment of perhaps personal privilege. First, I want to thank so many members of our staff who worked under unusual circumstances to make today go smoothly. Our secretary, Sean Wood-Hedworth, who just had her own little media frenzy, India Robinson and Judy Ingram, who made sure that as many people as possible could be in this room today, including many members of the press. And again, we welcome you all back at any time for further meetings. They worked so hard to make sure that everything went as smoothly as possible, and we really appreciate, on behalf of the Commission, I want to thank them for all of their hard work, given the unusual circumstances given today's meeting. And one last item, Brad Lipton has been serving with Commissioner Walther, Commissioner Weintraub, and I for the past year, although he has not been with the Commission quite as long as some of the others who have recently departed our agency. He has made incredible contributions to the work of the agency, and I know that all of us will miss his diligence, his hard work, his excellent writing, and his sense of humor. Brad is leaving us for good cause. He will be clerking in the fall for Judge John Bates in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and the year after that, he will be clerking for Judge David Tatel on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So, We will miss you. We assume that you would stay with us if not for these federal judges calling you. And as we do our best not to annoy federal judges here at the agency, we will send you with our best wishes. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to join in the thanks to Brad, who really has been a tremendous asset to our office and as a Yale man, besides. People come and people go around here, and some of them add more value than others. And Brad really did just throw himself into the work and was so excited to be working on rulemakings and things that I have to admit my eyes have started to glaze over when I look at some of these documents. And he brought new energy and new enthusiasm, and we're going to miss him. So thanks for everything, and I'm sorry we didn't get you a spot on the Colbert Show.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. I want to just say what a pleasure it's been to have you work with us. And from my perspective, it was just such a great fit. When he walked in the door the first time, he introduced himself, sat down, we had a nice chat, and he felt right at home, and I did too. And all the way through, it's just been a very comfortable relationship, very highly professional job, sense of humor. I think he even liked it. And so it really will be a loss for us, but also a pleasure to see where he's going. And I'm sure he'll really fit in both of those places and do a great job. And maybe someday he'll come back as commissioner.
So with our thanks, Brad, good luck with your future endeavors. Mr. Palmer, are there any management or administrative matters for the agency?
Madam Chair, there are none.
Thank you. With that, our meeting is adjourned.